The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and it's the day after Thanksgiving. Obviously, hope all of you had a wonderful time. If not, I hope it was at least peaceful. We have a great need for that on this planet. Harry Cooper is with us tonight. Harry, of course, the founder and president of Shark Hunters International, the world's largest and, well, it's really the only U-boat historical and membership organization. It's for mariners, aviators, people who served under all flags. It's a remarkable website, and Harry is a 10-man team doing remarkably scholarly work on many occasions. We're going to talk about some of that tonight. We're also going to take you on another patrol, which is what he lovingly calls his trips, and they are historically oriented. They take people to places that no normal tourist could ever get to, and then some. And we'll see some pictures tonight of some of that kind of thing and have some fun as well. Hello, Mr. Cooper. How are you?
Good evening. All 10 of us, 10-man team, we're here.
I see all of you there. Or is it my vision going?
Oh, yeah. I'm wearing my suit. I'm all set for your... I don't know which way the camera's facing, but I'm ready for I'm ready for air.
All right. We've got a photo button under Harry Cooper's name and guests at rents.com. Please take that button and load up page number one. So, now you were in Guatemala?
No, Honduras.
Honduras. I don't want to ask too many questions, but...
You can ask.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, just quick and briefly, we think there's another Area 51 type place there. On the far eastern end of Honduras, there's a province called Gracia de Dios, thanks to God, from what I understand, coming up the coast. Prior to that, there's coral reefs and rocks and everything, and the old Spaniards, once they got around that point, they had clear sailing, so they said, thanks to God, Gracia a Dios.
So it's called the Thank God Province, or point,
yeah,
or whatever.
Basically,
huh?
That's what it is. And that is a gigantic swamp filled with mosquitoes. And one of my contacts lives up there on Bruce Bay, which is at the pretty much far eastern end. He said every day for about 6 months, there'd be overflights of helicopters, the big Sikorsky S-64 sky cranes coming over, maybe half a dozen in a flight, and they'd all be carrying prefab houses. And another one of the guys lives in La Ceiba, which is further west along that coast. That coast runs east-west right there, rather than north-south.
Gotcha.
And he lived in La Ceiba, and he said for about the same time period, he'd see the big sky cranes coming over, carrying what appeared to be gigantic fuel bladders.
Huh.
So
marked or unmarked? Anybody get an ID on them and which direction they were coming from?
Well, we got an ID where they were coming from, but never bothered to ask if they had an ID, but who has? Nobody else has Sikorsky sky cranes except us.
And that's not a big logging operation down there either, so.
No, not in the swamp.
They were bringing things, yes, that was my joke. They were bringing things in.
Yeah.
Okay, well, once again, American tax dollars seem to be hard at work.
And they obviously had to be coming from some type of a carrier they don't know, but probably a small helicopter scow and maybe other cargo ship out there that was carrying the fuel bladders.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, they didn't have the range to come from the U.S. I don't think so. So they were coming from ships offshore.
Right.
And my guy from who has the house at Bruce Bay said that they've got the high wire all around the compound with the same kind of signs they had at Area 51 that basically said the guards have the right to shoot you dead. But that's a way of life. My God, I've never been to a country like Honduras before. I've been all over the world, but my buddy who lives there has been there 23 years, and 23 of his friends have been shot dead so far. The houses all have high walls around them with broken glass on the top, barbed wire above that.
Wait a minute. This is a little enclave of houses with high security. Shoot to kill signs. It's a community.
Yeah.
It's some kind of a community.
That's what you would think.
Did you get any binocular views of it or anything?
Nope, and neither did they. That's as much as we got.
That's much. All right. Well, I don't want to push any further than that. That's
the
very
rest
interesting.
Of it, with a photo of a map, et cetera, that'll all be in our next monthly magazine.
Has he seen any unusual flying objects besides Sikorsky sky cranes? They're pretty weird looking.
No, not yet. So maybe it's not an Area 51 for aviation. Maybe it's a base for clandestine operations. That much we don't know yet. Although we do know there's a big U.S. Air Force base there in the right near the capital city of Tegucigalpa. There's a big U.S. Air Base, and there's also an Army base around there, too, a U.S. Army base.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all out in the open, but the what's in this other place, I don't know. If I ever get goofy enough to go back to Honduras, we'll chase it a little further, but right now we've got other people down there who are looking into it for us.
Sky cranes still flying, or are they done their thing?
No, they stopped some months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Did
he get photos of any of them?
No, they didn't think to do that. I got to train my spooks a little better.
Yeah, well, you got part of it.
We got part of the story.
Good. Okay,
but
very
now
good.
Now, the big thing, I'm going, we're heading back to Argentina, and as you know, I've been to Argentina three times so far, twice out to Patagonia, where Hitler lived from 1945 until 1955, and the other time up to Cordoba, where he lived from 55 until he died in, I think it was 1962. We now have an appointment with the lady who was the waitress who waited on Hitler and Ava Hitler in 1949, and a ton more stuff. And that's all on the website, too. People can go on the website, www.sharkhunters.com, and click on, I think it says something like Fantastic Tours or Fantastic Patrols, my website. You think I know what it says. And that'll tell all about what I'm going to go see in Argentina.
Now, it does say fantastic new books available now.
Yeah, that's another one, yep.
Now, the tours are open to anyone, and I don't know how many spaces you still have available.
Oh, we still have some available.
Okay, good. Well, look for
To Argentina, it's a very, very small tour.
Okay. Fantastic Shark Hunters Patrols.
There you go.
Third Reich Settlement and Scientific Center, and we've seen the pictures of those in our previous radio broadcast. That's remarkable material down there. Now, this other thing about the Gray Wolf book, do you want to get into that a little bit?
Yeah, okay.
I mean, this is First Amendment stuff, and, what is. Theft is theft, and plagiarism is plagiarism.
First off, we came out with our book. Well, we came out with the story of Hitler's escape almost 20 years ago in our magazine. We did it in a serial basis, month after month after month. And then about 10 years ago, we came out with our book called Escape from the Bunker. And there's no doubt he escaped. We have hundreds of files from the FBI that state flatly they know he got away. The OSS We've also got files from the Dutch Secret Service. They all knew Hitler got away. They knew where he was, etc. And there's a fellow down there by the name of Abel Bastik, B-A-S-T-I.
Yeah, let's talk about Abel in just a couple minutes. We have to break. Harry Cooper is with us, and Harry and I are going to have a lot of fun, and you're invited. Don't miss the next section especially, because this Abel Bastik is the man. He has an incredible wealth of data on Eva and Adolf's time in Argentina, and it's the real deal. So stay tuned. I'll be right back. Okay, the man in Argentina's name is Abel, A-B-E-L, Basti, B-A-S-T-I. Who is he, and how did he come by all this material, Harry?
Abel Basti is a member of Shark Hunters since 2008, and there's pictures of him on my website if you go to previous tours and then click on the 2008 Argentina tour. He works, I think he's a, he publishes a magazine down there for airline travelers. And because he lives not too far from where Hitler lived, and the town was full of SS officers up until recently when, you know, the Grim Reaper has gotten everybody. And every year on 20th of April, which was Hitler's birthday, they'd have a big shindig, big party at one of the upscale hotels there, out in the middle of nowhere, 700 miles southwest of Buenos Aires. And at the end of the war, that really was could have been the dark side of the moon, or was something out there.
This is Bariloche.
That's San Carlos de Bariloche. That's correct. And so he started researching because that's where he lived, and he got a tremendous amount of information because he started on it early enough to where a lot of people were alive. And so these two fellows who wrote this new book, Gray Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler, looked him up, and from what I understand, they and from what I hear from Abel and from various other of our contacts down there, they were spreading money around almost like Obama throwing money around. They had, according to Abel, they had pretty well wasted about $1 million. They had like 200 people in the group. I don't know how you're gonna they were gonna first do a film and then a book. I don't know what you need 200 people for to film a movie.
That's extraordinary. That's taking an entire production company and then some. That doesn't make sense.
Right. I mean, it's not like they were filming Gone with the Wind. This was a documentary.
No.
We've done documentaries with half a dozen people.
Sure.
And apparently one of the authors brought his best friend with him, Jim Beam.
Oh, yeah.
And spent most of the time drunk. And watched the new film, The Producers, you know, Springtime for Hitler.
Yeah,
Germany,
yeah, yeah.
You know, and every night he watched that. Plus he brought in a an escort, we'll say, a very high-priced escort who lived with him for the time they were down there, pretty much.
I see.
And got a tremendous amount of information from Abel, and another one of our contacts down there, Nahuel Coca, helped open the doors so they could interview a lot of people from the Argentine Navy and from the Argentine government, and they got a tremendous amount of information. And then, according to Abel, they just pulled the plug because the financiers back in England, I guess, were pretty upset at the way the money was being just thrown out.
Yeah.
And so they slammed the checkbook shut. And so the whole effort just evaporated and went home one day. And Cable apparently did not get paid like he was supposed to. Yet they had most of his resources, most of information that he gave to them, they kept.
And why did he share it with them?
They paid him. They were going to pay him. But apparently they... Now, he's been trying to go big time with this story for a long time. He wrote a book called Nazis in Argentina, I think it was the title, or something similar.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only published in Spanish in Argentina. Now, that's not a huge, big market.
Is this after your book?
Oh, yes. And his book kind of paralleled mine without infringing on it.
I see.
And I kept telling Abel to get the book translated into English and sell it in the U.S. market.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it would go big time. Well, we never got it translated, so it never really flew. And so these guys, according to Nahuel, they were just pouring money out lavishly.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Nahuel, they were kind of seduced by the money. Well, then all of a sudden, like I say, they just pulled the plug and went back to England without hardly a fare-thee-well. And they did a small documentary, which I guess was airing on Australian TV recently.
They took the whole 200 group left.
Yeah, everybody just gone. They, you know, this is something that they did something that drives me nuts, too. I was instrumental in getting some stuff done for the History Channel, which they were nice people. They put a production and film crew together, and we went over to Germany, 15 years ago, to interview the skippers, because they wanted to interview the skippers, and they couldn't even get a reply. And because the skippers were all members of Shark Hunters and friends of mine, I got the door
sure.
open. We went over.
Got it.
Okay, everything was fine. Everything was on the up and up. They had us in hotels, my God, like 4-star, 5-star hotels. And the same thing with these guys. They were staying in lavish hotels down there, having huge, big dinners. And you don't need to do that, especially now the Yankee dollar is so strong against the Argentine peso. When we go, we stay in a really, really nice hotel run mm-hmm. by the Argentine Navy. A very nice place. Breakfast included in a beautiful breakfast room. Looks like the quarter deck of a ship. And we pay about $40 a night. These guys were just spending hundreds of dollars a night. And big fancy meals. You can get a nice meal, a great steak, because Argentine beef is really excellent. Doesn't have the growth hormones in it. And you can have a glass of wine, a nice steak dinner, after dinner drinks, and maybe you'll spend $10 Yankee money.
Wow.
But they were blowing money left and right. According to my contacts, they were spending money at a hell of a rate. And so the financiers just shut the checkbook and they went back home. The book came out about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And while the basic premise is correct, Hitler did indeed get out of the bunker. He did indeed make it to South America, and he lived out his life in Argentina. But the book goes on and on. I used to joke with Clay Blair, the guy that wrote Hitler's U-Boats and many, many other really great books. I used to joke with him that he must have got paid by the word. And I'm wondering about these guys, too, because there were many chapters on Argentina from the year 1536. Who cares about that when you're talking about Hitler living in Argentina? It also goes on to talk about...
So they padded it.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of it goes on to talk about the land battles of World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Had nothing to do with Hitler's escape. But then there are many, many places where they are quoting people, and there's no evidence that the conversations actually took place. There's another glaring thing where it's talking about U-boat U-234. And in the book it says that they left Germany, and when they got into the North Atlantic, Captain Fahler opened sealed orders and went to, was going to go someplace, I forget which. Well, first off, Fahler never had sealed orders. He was a member of Shark Hunters. I knew him well. I spent a day talking with him in his home in Hamburg.
Mm-hmm.
His first officer was a member. His cargo officer was a member, and his chief radioman was a member.
Wow. Hold it right there, would you please? We have to pause, and we'll pick it up right there with Harry in just a couple minutes. Fascinating history, real deal for you, and more in just a few. Hang on. Okay, right back to it. Do load those pictures. We're going to take off on our patrol here in just a few minutes. All right, go ahead. U-234.
Right. That was a big mine-laying submarine that had been converted into cargo.
Uh-huh.
And he had one mission. He was to go down the west coast of Africa, around the Cape of Good Hope, through the Indian Ocean, into the Pacific, and go to Tokyo. He had many very important people on board. Scientists who were later picked up by Operation Paperclip. He had a Luftwaffe lieutenant general and his staff all bound for Tokyo. He also had 560 kilograms, which is about, 1,200 pounds of uranium on board, consigned to the Japanese Army. He had no secret mission off the United States, as this book alludes. He had one mission, and that was to get to Tokyo. The war ended.
Mm-hmm.
He got the surrender order while they were en route, and so they surrendered to the U.S., but there was no sealed orders. There were no, and the book offers no proof of any of this stuff. For instance, allegedly when the Soviets rushed into the Fuhrer bunker, there were 12 female doctors, and according to the book, it quotes the head doctor, the leader of the female doctors, saying, voiced Hitler, it translates to "Where is Hitler?" and "Where is Hitler? Where is Eva's party gowns?" There's just no backup for that.
Okay,
so we're going through that in our magazine and the next issue that comes out. Also, we're finding out so much more stuff. We may have to put another page onto our website with all the documentation.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, they left quite a trail behind them in Buenos Aires. And Abel Basti is suing them now for plagiarism.
Good for him. I hope it sticks. I really have no need for cheats and thieves like that when it comes to intellectual material, especially.
And there's no reason to steal stuff from anybody like that. They had a deal with Abel. All they had to do was be honest and fulfill their end of the deal. But apparently, this one particular author was a serious alcoholic and was spending money that needlessly and stupidly just because he had it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this high-priced escort with him.
He was a big shot.
Yeah, he was a pseudo big shot.
Yeah.
So now it's going to come back to bite him in the butt.
Good. All right. Okay, well, we have covered Hitler and Eva in Argentina on this program, and you can hear them in the archives. You can go to sharkhunters.com and listen to them there if you'd like as well. They are absolutely fascinating, and they're full of pictures. You can watch and listen as we go, like we're going to do tonight. All right, so let's go on our patrol, sir. Where are you going to take us this evening?
Okay, this is a patrol we did a year or two ago in and around Berlin. And a lot of places people can go on their own. A lot of places are off limits. Mm-hmm. And they have that special sign that says Angang Verboten, which means only shark hunters can come here.
That's right. Yeah, you've gotten into places, and I know this from talking to you so much.
We'll see some of them here on this picture display. The first picture there where it says the Waldschenk restaurant, I just put that up because it's a beautiful restaurant that we visit all the time. The next three pictures, that is the palace of a prince. It's called Cecilienhof, and this is where the big three held their meeting after the German surrender to carve up the German carcass, as it was described.
Yeah.
Churchill, Roosevelt, no, not Roosevelt, he was already, did the world a favor and assumed room temperature. It was Truman and Stalin. And
that's the room, and those allegedly are the chairs?
That's correct.
Uh-huh.
And those are the three flags showing the three powers that were there. You'll notice there's no French flag because they deliberately excluded France. Because France really didn't have much to do anyhow. Charles de Gaulle was over in England running his government in exile. And basically the U.S. and England told him, just sit here and be quiet, Charles. Right. We'll get your country back for you. Just don't get away.
Now, there were some men and women in the resistance who were brave, but by and large, the fabled French resistance of World War II was a sham. It just didn't happen.
Right, and their military, actually, they haven't had a real, I hope I don't upset your listeners, but France hasn't had a really powerful military since Napoleon.
Well, they got nuclear warheads on submarines now, and
they do.
That makes them fairly powerful, but yes, they don't have a big standing army per se. They're tripling their presence in, I guess it's Mali, anyway, somewhere in Central Africa.
Yeah.
They're down there. It's funny, when the French began their recent escapade down there, one of the first things we did was go in, and I believe it was in Niger, Special Forces America went in there and put up a perimeter guard around the Nigerian uranium mines.
Oh, kind of making sure it doesn't go into the into the wrong direction. Yeah,
I guess. I'm not sure where the wrong direction is anymore.
I don't know either.
Walt Kelly,
my career
I think.
Field when I was in the service, I was in command of 6-man team loading hydrogen bombs onto B-47s.
Wow.
And you know, of course, our esteemed leader there, what's his name, Barry Satoru.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Barack Obama.
No, it's Barry.
Yeah, he wants to get rid of our nuclear weapons and just kind of lay down and say, okay, we got rid of ours, please don't kill us. Get rid of yours, please. Yeah, right.
Amazing.
He's not making stupid decisions. He's doing that deliberately, but that's another whole topic.
Yep.
The one thing that kind of rubs everybody raw about this Cecilienhof is that big red star made out of flowers, that because this was in the Russian zone, yet the German government maintains that big red star.
That star should go immediately.
Yeah, I know.
Come on, folks. You know the game.
I would think a big lawnmower would do the job.
Yeah. Lenin and Stalin presided over the deaths of maybe 100 million people. We don't know.
Right. Yeah, well. It's a good thing we didn't do anything like that on our side.
Nah, we only never.
Yeah, the Eisenhower starvation camps, etc. But that's another topic too.
Yep.
Then
well,
we see that bridge.
We'll go through this, Brett. Go ahead, Harry.
Okay. If you're an old fart like I am, you remember the Cold War when we'd catch Soviet spies and they'd catch American spies. They would exchange them, and this was the bridge. It was between East and West Berlin.
Yeah, they'd walk out, meet them halfway.
That's it. This is the very bridge.
Huh.
And it used to be American businessmen were being grabbed up by the Soviets. And when I was a young man back then, I always thought, no, these bums, they're grabbing just honest people who are not doing anything and claiming they were spies, so they've got some kind of leverage. Well, baloney. When I went into... I was invited to the Soviet Union by the commander-in-chief of the Navy, Vladimir Chernyavin, who was directed to invite me by Mikhail Gorbachev. I got a call from the CIA. They gave me a list of people to take pictures of, et cetera, et cetera. So businessmen go there, and they get scooped up.
Huh.
So
Was that bridge around, is that a World War II vintage bridge?
Oh, it's way before that.
Uh-huh.
It's looks been around old. For a long time.
Yeah, it looks old. Seen a lot of history.
Yeah.
Okay.
And actually, we have a mansion, which is the famous Wannsee House. This is where the so-called Wannsee Conference took place. And we go there because it's a beautiful building, but unfortunately, it's turned into a, how do you say it, a documentation center, which generally means it's a memorial to how mean the Germans were to a certain
group. Yeah, it's an anti-German propaganda reservoir. Yeah,
and it's free. You know, anytime you find a free museum over there, you know what the underlying theme is.
Mm-hmm.
So we go there because it's beautiful, and then the next picture down there is looking out from the front balcony over the Wannsee. And if you remember, now you get our magazine, this is where the 3rd and 4th of May, 1945, a couple of the big Blumenbos BV-138 flying boats landed and took people out. We still don't know who they took out. But
who was it that watched them land? Somebody was up there on the hillside and watched. I can't remember now. I read this.
Yeah, it was a Navy chief petty officer.
One survivor of his whole unit, and
And so we were telling his story in our magazine. And incidentally, your listeners can send us an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net and just ask for a sample copy of the magazine electronically, and we'll send it electronically.
Very nice. Yeah. Great piece of history. It's really a nice thing. Good.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun putting it together. And as you know, in the last one, we showed where that the last of the big six-engine Junkers Ju-390 aircraft landed down in Uruguay. And we're 99.5% certain it was carrying the so-called Nazi bell on board. But that's another topic. Then we see this grown-up picture with all the weeds grown up.
The bell is, just for our listeners, the bell is also known as die Glock.
Die Glock, which is the German word for the bell.
Yeah, and that was their anti-grav or whatever was propelling it, their breakthrough.
Right, anti-grav or a dimension bending
something.
It was an incredibly high-speed rotor, which had a chemical in there called Zerum, X-E-R-U-M, Zerum 525 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it was under control of General Kammler also. It was a great enigma.
Well, we know more about him now, don't we?
Yeah, we're learning more and more about
him. After talking to Clark, did you pick up some...
Oh, yeah. Clark and I had lunch together after you put us in contact. He's a very, very nice fella.
Yeah, really.
And went to a German restaurant near him. Oh, he just loved the place. Great food there, too. Also, our number one spook of all our spooks, the guy we call Pizarro, he has access to so many of the archives that were just abandoned when the Stasi moved out of East Berlin.
Uh-huh.
And East Germany, and he's got so much stuff that he's, you know, sending to us, which we publish in our magazine. And there's stuff in the magazine you'll never get anywhere else. So anyhow, now we look at that abandoned building there, and everybody knows about Checkpoint Charlie. Everybody's seen pictures of that. But what about Checkpoint Bravo? This is all the remains of Checkpoint Bravo, and we stopped by, and we'll visit that. And I remember the first time we went into East Berlin. We were in East Berlin on the day of reunification. Only shark hunters can do that.
Wow, that's quite an amazing feat.
Yeah, and Checkpoint Bravo was open and running at that time, and we had to stop. And all the cars and buses and everything had to drive slowly over pits, and they had Stasi guys down in the pit looking to make sure you didn't have anything underneath your vehicle or whatever. But now it's just abandoned, and we go there to visit. Then we walk down the Autobahn, and we don't get run over. You'll see the two ruts in the woods. That was the Autobahn that was built under Hitler from Berlin to Munich.
Really? That was the main, that was the big interstate, so to speak.
That is correct.
So that must have been four lanes.
It
or
was.
At least.
And Eva Braun would be running her beautiful red Mercedes down there, and the troops would be moving down there. But now the Soviets, when they were still there, built around this, a new Autobahn around this, and this is being left for nature to open.
Amazing how nature reclaims. And the graffiti...
Yeah, that's one of their bridges on that Autobahn.
Well, should be cleaned up and restored, of course, but...
Yeah, and try to get the German government to see it that way.
It's not the German government anymore.
Well, what can I say? I'm not going to get into that, but you and
I did.
Are singing out of the same songbook.
Yeah.
They now have signs. They didn't used to have signs along that abandoned Autobahn, but now they've got signs saying that this is a nature preserve, and you're not allowed to inhibit the growth of the plants and flowers.
I see. Yeah.
In other words, get out of the way, let nature take it over.
Well, there's a nice picture of it, and there's two lanes each direction, correct?
Yeah. But
well, what a beautiful drive that must have been.
Yeah, historic, too. On all our tours, when we go to places like this, unless you're dead, your imagination has to go back, and you have to be able to see in your mind's eye.
Yes.
What was going on back then, and
sure.
And hear the people, hear Eva Braun go by in her red Mercedes, et cetera, et cetera.
Can you still drive down that at all? To let shark hunters take a little couple of cars?
Nobody can drive on that. It's you can't even get onto it. You can get onto it by foot.
Uh huh.
But well, maybe if you had a tracked vehicle or a four wheel drive. But there's
Does the pavement still go on for a good distance?
It goes on for quite a ways. It's now being used as a walking path.
Uh-huh.
It goes on for a couple of miles.
Uh-huh. Huh.
And, you can almost see the spirits of those who were there.
Ghosts.
Yep.
PKW.
I don't know what that means, but that was the border between East and West Berlin at that point. Then you see the three flag poles that are all being grown up. All the forest is growing up around it. That used to be the three flag poles for the Soviet flag, the East German flag, and God knows what else they used to have there. And that bashed up building, outside and inside, that was a restaurant and rest area, you know, as you were crossing from the west into the east, you could stop there. But now it's gone to hell, as you can see. And the interesting thing with all these old buildings, now this doesn't have a whole lot of historical significance because it was built by the Soviets and it's falling apart. But as you'll see later, magnificent buildings built in the time of the Kaiser, but used by the Reich. There, and other ones that are built by the Reich. The law now in Germany says that anything built in the Hitler years must not be taken apart, must not be torn down, must be left alone. Well, now they're leaving them alone, and you'll see that there appears to be deliberate.
That means vandals come here, please. Yeah.
That's exactly correct. And eventually they'll say, oh, well, it's not safe. We have to tear it down. So,
All right. Let's
see. There's that sign there. It says, Berliner Mauerwerk, in other words, the wall wrote. And the red line there shows where the Berlin Wall used to stand right at that area. That's right by the Teltow Canal, which was the scene of bitter fighting in the last moments of the war. And one of our friends who is our guide over there, has a house that used to belong to a Stasi colonel, and it right smack at the Berlin Wall. The wall used to run down the street right in front of his house, and he was in the East Berlin side. Then we see a bunker, and again, this one is, it's off limits, but it's not patrolled, so.
It's a large building.
That's a large building.
On top.
Yeah, and actually, if you go down a little bit, you see the doorway going in, then you see more graffiti. So those taggers are busy over there.
Yeah.
And you see it's actually an air raid bunker, and you see the guy standing there with the cap and the green
mm-hmm.
jacket.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's the son of a guy who went with us, Erwin Burt. Erwin rode U-boats during World War II, and he was one of the lucky ones to come out of it alive.
Mm.
And he was with us, and this was his son. He and I had flashlights, and we went in there, and you see there's the beat-up stairwell, et cetera. And
is that the original green paint and red trim from the war?
It's the original from when the Soviets took over.
I see.
This is all in the Soviet bloc.
It's probably all
DDR.
I bet it was white originally.
Yeah, that's probably. And it was maintained a lot better than this.
Yeah.
Then we go down, we see the building with the little knee-high fence in front of it. That's the mansion on the outskirts of Berlin where Jodl and Keitel and one or two other generals signed the unconditional surrender. And in doing so, Jodl and Keitel signed their own death warrant because they were adjudged war criminals.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look down, you'll see a copy of an actual World War II picture of that surrender ceremony. And those guys, this was taken right as they were signing the surrender, and we're actually in that room. There are many more photos of this on the website, including me standing behind those flags. It doesn't show the rope we had to step over to get the photos. But
are those allegedly the same tables and chairs still?
Yes. Yes, they are.
And
it's
the door
turned into, it was turned into a Soviet museum. And then after the Soviet Union imploded, the German government just kept it open as a museum.
Uh-huh.
They got a lot of stuff, a lot of interesting stuff in there. It's pretty heavily Soviet because that's who put the museum together in the first place.
You know, I look at that old picture, well, old 45, and look at the dignity still.
Yeah.
In those I'm not saying, look, it's just an historical fact that that's where the surrender was, but they didn't drag their tails in there. They stood tall and proud for the country they fought for.
Yeah, that's true. And you notice they all had their heads up, heads held high.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. No.
Did they have to surrender when they did? Was there any hope of fighting on for any reason, or did they do the right thing?
No, they didn't have a prayer of winning ever since Roosevelt at the Yalta convention.
Yeah, well, he gave away Eastern Europe. Yeah.
He said only unconditional surrender. If he hadn't made that statement, the German generals were ready to work out some kind of honorable surrender.
So was Hess.
Well, yeah, Hess was already in British custody for some
time. That's why he went there, though. That's why he was sent.
Oh, that's correct. And one of our members, Charles Higham, who was a really great researcher, writer, was doing a story on how Churchill's people knew Hess was coming over and they wanted to intercept him before he could get to the Duke of whatever, I think it was Duke of Argyle, who was a cousin of the king, because Churchill wanted to keep that war going, and they just grabbed him. And unfortunately, the book never got finished because our member woke up dead one morning.
Charles Higham?
Charles Higham, yeah.
That's very interesting. Yeah, well, hold on. I have to take a break here, and we'll come right back. Yeah, fascinating tour. We're on patrol with Harry, and we'll continue that in just a couple minutes. Okay, and we're back. On patrol with Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com, and we are currently in what used to be East Germany. There's Harry sitting onto the truck. Load photos. I know what that is, too. Load photos under Harry Cooper's name in guests, and you'll get to see where we are going and join the patrol with us. That's a Russian rocket launcher.
That's correct. That's a Katyusha rocket, sometimes called the Stalin pipe organ.
Yeah.
You see them in the war films, and they're going off, and you're... And, you know, at the other end, there's...
Right.
Death and destruction everywhere. And we just threw in a few nice photos of downtown Berlin at Alexanderplatz, which is the heart of Berlin, and that round-looking thing. It says it's the Soviet world clock. It was built by the Soviets to show what time it was, what date it was, etc., any place in the world. And, again, these are all places anybody can go. But we get into places where other people can't go quite so much.
Mm-hmm.
The next batch, you slow me down
whenever
you want.
The streetcars. Always like streetcars.
Right. They still run them. And in one of the places, I forget where it was. No, this was in South Germany, in Munich. They still have a line where they're running the old streetcars from the war years.
The same cars.
Yeah.
Good for them.
Yeah. It really brings back, you know, brings you back 70 years.
Yeah.
By looking at them.
That's wild.
Yeah.
Okay.
Then we're at the flak term. You see a girl climbing up.
Okay. We're going to go to photos two.
Yeah. Photo two.
Photos two and, okay. So, flaktum, F-L-A-K-T-U-R-M, flaktum.
Right.
What is this person doing? Just having a little daring do?
Yeah, climbing up.
Uh-huh.
Flak, F-L-A-K, it's from the German Flugzeug Abwehr Kanon, in other words,
anti-aircraft.
Anti-aircraft, right. And Turm means tower. We went there, too, but we didn't have to scale the walls. We just walked up the steps, a whole lot of steps. And this was an active anti-aircraft battery during the war. There were several of them around Berlin. They mounted the famous 88 guns on top, the 88 millimeters. They also had 37 millimeter and 20 millimeter anti-aircraft for the fighters that got down low on the deck. The big guns, the 88, were to knock down the bombers. And more Allied bombers were knocked down by the 88 millimeter cannons than were shot down by the Luftwaffe.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's one of the little-known facts of the war. The Luftwaffe shot down an awful lot of airplanes, but the 88 guns brought down a lot more.
I have a recording of a Beethoven piano concerto done in a concert hall in Berlin by Walter Gieseking, during the war, probably 1944, and these were amazing people. Outside, in the night, during the middle of this conference, you can hear the 88s going off.
Right.
And they were playing, and the house was full, and the bombers were overhead. Didn't hear any bombs hit, but the 88s in the background. It's quite an interesting little glimpse, little tiny little fragment of history.
Right, and the people in the concert hall were all dressed properly. The men were wearing suits. The ladies were wearing dresses with hats.
Absolutely.
We have a DVD we sell of German symphony music from the war years and showed exactly that. I remember, too, though, during the war years, my mother always wore a hat and white gloves when she went shopping in downtown Chicago. My father worked in Chicago. He always wore a suit and a hat. You had to have a cover. That was your hat.
Yep.
And without that, you weren't fully put together. now we go to places where the sign says Eingangver Boten, which means only shark hunters can come here. There's a place called the Bogensee House, and it says on the picture there it was Goebbels' house.
This was his home?
This was his home. The Reich built him a nice home outside the city, but it wasn't big enough, so he built this place himself, House Bogensee, because it was on a lake, which has since dried up. But you can't go there, and other than us.
And so this is kind of fenced off, walled off? And
yes, you betcha.
And you walked in, you guys got in. That's actually the driveway I see.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating.
Well, we know the right people to talk to.
Sure.
To turn the key.
Well, you are held in, you and your organization, but especially you are held in such regard by people who get it. And that's
right.
Really nice.
Yeah. And we, you know, they are so pleased that we're telling their story honestly. The U-boat guys have told me, now we've been at this 30 years, coming on 31 in February. The U-boat guys have told me personally that shark hunters has given them back their self-esteem.
Wonderful.
So, yeah. Now this home, Goebbels, of course, was head of the propaganda and also head of the film industry. And he had a whole wing. There was nothing but bedrooms. And you'll see by the statues there, it was kind of his love nest. And the picture of that beautiful girl, you see that girl wearing the white mink?
Yeah.
That Lidia Borova. She was, I think, from Czechoslovakia. She was from one of the other countries to the
very
east.
And exotic-looking Eastern European. Yeah.
Right. And she was an up-and-coming movie star and incredibly famous. And she was also a guest out there with Dr. Goebbels. And it got so transparent that her fiancé just told her adios, you know, because she was in bed with Goebbels so much. Goebbels went to Hitler and said he wanted to divorce his wife Magda and marry this girl, and Hitler says, that ain't the way the National Socialists work. Get rid of the girl. And so Lydia had to head back to wherever she came from, or she would have been assassinated. So that was Joseph Goebbels. And just beyond, below that picture, you see two fairly large windows. Well, these windows actually, you push a button and they would retract down into the basement, thereby allowing airflow. And I personally pushed the button to run those windows up and down.
Oh, how much fun.
Yeah. And, of course, there's no pictures of them here because we've got hundreds and hundreds of pictures. We'd need a two-week-long show to do them all. But we've got other pictures in there, also down in the basement.
That's where we are with the flash in the upper left. That's where down below.
No, that's the main room that you see once you go through those windows.
I gotcha.
Ballroom or a salon, whatever. But
same floor.
Same
floor tile. Same.
That's correct. Yeah, it's on the ground floor.
Wow.
But then you go down into the basement, and the big cooler is still there for the meat. And the big cooler is still there for the vegetables and all the food prep stuff down there, plus the entrance to his own bunker layout underground. And we went through that bunker. I don't have any pictures of it up here, but there are pictures on.
So this the inside of the house, Bogensee, is still in good condition. I see the one picture of the entrance. The paint is peeling away.
Yeah.
But the inside is still, they obviously keep it, there's some security around there.
Oh, there's a lot of security around there.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting situation. At one time, a few years ago, the German government, who owns the property, was going to put it up for auction and make some money. They figured they'd get 3 or 4 million euros out of it.
Yeah.
And And because there's a lot more on the property that the Soviets built, which we'll see directly. And then they were going to put it up for auction. And some clever politician says, wait a minute, some wealthy Nazi might buy it, neo-Nazi, and use it as a meeting place for neo-Nazis. So now they've taken it off the market, and it's just sitting there, falling apart. Mm. And like I say, there's many, many more photos on the website, including the bunkers, the sliding windows, etc. It's all on the website.
Sharkhunters.com, folks. Just
yes,
look
sir.
For the 2012 patrol, and
right.
you'll see all of them there. Brett, we're going to keep going here. We got a lot of photos, so go
yeah.
ahead, Harry.
And you slow me down or speed me up as you need. The next one you see, there's a sign that says House Bogensee.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about, where the paint is peeling on the entrance up on the top.
Right. This is not his house. This was not his house. This was one of the buildings built by the East Germans. They had a bunch of dormitory houses like this for the Hitler Youth, but not Hitler Youth. It was the young communists, Komsomolets. All the young communists would come there for rallies, and they'd put them up. They had one house for the people, communists from Czechoslovakia, one from, you know, this land and one from that land. And then you see the big fancy building where it says Memories of the Soviet Union, and there's kind of like pine trees all
yeah.
around in front
yeah.
of it.
Yeah.
That was a meeting center or whatever. They would have meetings. They would have graduation classes. They also had...
The young communists?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
They also had one huge room that was set up with special chairs where they would have state meetings in there, and they would plug in earphones to receptacles on each chair so that the translators could translate for the various different languages. And also they had two huge big Zeiss movie projectors up in the projection room, and we were up there, and those Zeiss projectors are still there. I mean, they're huge big things, weigh a couple of tons, and they're all just going to hell. But I guess that's the way it's planned.
Well, the Zeiss optical dynasty was untouched in Europe. I'm surprised they're still there, and they wouldn't at least try to maintain them.
Well,
I guess not. You know.
I guess not. It takes
yeah.
money.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've got plenty of money to give away to people coming in claiming it's asylum, but they have
I
money
understand.
To take care of their own heritage. But
of course not.
I'll probably be in trouble next time I go over there.
Well, it's the truth. I mean, come on. It's just the truth. It's how it's allocated.
Doesn't exist quite the same way that you and I are.
Well, a friend of mine is Ernst Zundel, and I you know Ingrid. And
yeah, well, Ernst Zundel was a member of Shark Hunters up until he ran into trouble with the law.
Yeah.
Now he doesn't have email or internet, so he can't get the magazine that way. We do send the magazine in hard copy to members who really want it that way in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And out of thousands of members, we have 155 members who get it hard copy, but only in the U.S. because outside the U.S., the postage is just killing.
Mm.
$5 or $6 per magazine to send it overseas.
Wow. Okay, we got a picture of a classic VW.
Yeah.
Looks like a new...
Actually a Mercedes.
Is it? I can't quite make it out. Oh, there. Yes, it is a Mercedes. It looks like the, just from the front end of it, like the old VW thing. It's
similar,
the same.
Only a little bigger.
Gotcha, I see.
And four-wheel drive, and that's the that's the guard, and there's that sign, I'm gang verboten, that says Shark Hunters are welcome here.
Yeah.
And he takes us in, and we walk past that bomb shelter, which is kind of sunk down into the ground. It was a two-man bomb shelter, only... You know, for the sentries, if the air raids came, they'd duck inside there and probably scared the hell out of them. But they'd come out alive. Then we have two pictures called the Soviet barracks. You'll notice they didn't waste a lot of money on walls. They built these things down into the ground. I have no idea why they built them into the ground. But this was for the Soviet Army, the East German Army. You see the window sticking down in the ground and the
sure.
roof down on the ground?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, this is on the complex called Korale, which means coral. And this was where Admiral Dönitz had his headquarters after they were run out of France. The Soviets built this other group of buildings out there, and including these sunken buildings. Now, you see our friend there, who never faces the camera, and probably a good reason he doesn't face the camera, standing by a small lake. There were four or six, I can't remember which, of these false lakes on the property, and some buildings that made it look like a farm. So the bombers wouldn't think there was any reason to drop bombs there.
It was camouflage, okay.
Yeah, exactly. And below that, there's a picture of the mess hall of the Soviet Union, the DDR.
The East German, the real Germans in East Germany, probably don't have fond memories of their occupation at all, I wouldn't think.
Yeah, some do, some don't. Some do, the younger ones who didn't grow up during the war years. They, you know, they were indoctrinated. But, you know, they're finally realizing they're living a whole lot better now in a free market society than they were back during the Soviet days. And they got freedom of movement in the Soviet days, you know. You were a prisoner behind those walls. They told the people they built those walls to keep the American tanks out. And it's not true at all. It was to keep the workers in. So then we go on. We see.
I'm at the Kriegsmarine pictures here.
Yep. We got heavy undergrowth, underbrush, and we keep on going through it. And we see a wall that was Corrali, the command bunker. All those cinder blocks up on top. That was built after the war. That was built by the DDR so they could practice urban assaults. Read into that what you want.
Yeah.
Then we go down, we see the actual bunker. It was blown up by the Soviets, which was the agreement they had with the Americans, any bunkers they were using. When the Soviet Union evaporated, they just blew them up. The same as Wolfschanze, where the attempt was made on Hitler's life in Rastenburg, which used to be East Prussia, which is now part of Poland. They blew everything up. Now we see another gate with another one of them signs that says shark hunters are welcome.
Yeah, that's a wild-looking gate.
Yeah.
A spider web.
It's older than you and I. And then you see stairways going to nowhere with a yellow arrow. That's the entrance to Dönitz's underground bunker. And you'll see the next one. I'm shooting down into the bunker. That's the first level.
Wow.
It goes down three levels. And
this is where this was the command and control center for the German submarine fleet.
Yeah, for
and
the
Navy.
Whole German Navy, actually.
The whole Navy.
Marina.
Yeah.
Because at that time, Carl Dönitz was a rear admiral in charge. Well, no, by then he was Kunter. No, check that. He was Gross Admiral, Grand Admiral. He was in command of the whole Navy.
So I'm looking down in this obviously very well-built bunker.
Yep.
And it goes down three stories deep.
Three levels, right. And there's one picture there of the furnace, and just other random photos down in there.
Furnace would be to warm the whole place, I assume. That's
well,
the central furnace.
The furnace, and then the one picture where you see just a pair of legs. That's by the sump pump. That's down three levels down. We're about 200 feet under the surface there. And in case any water would come in, that would pump it back out again, keep the place, you know, dry while it was going on. They built them pretty good. They pretty well denuded the world of concrete back in those days. And experts say that whatever the Germans built above the ground, they built about four times as much below the ground.
Now, these are in the major cities.
This was outside of Berlin. It was probably.
I mean, all this growth above ground, and then four times below ground. That
was
that's in
the
Berlin.
Germans were.
Everywhere they were. So, in other words, Berlin, as we speak right now, has underground facilities that people may not even have been in since the war.
That's correct. The Führer Bunker, which is Hitler's command headquarters, was paved over, and we'll see where it is a little further on in this. But in the 1990s, I forgot the exact year, there was an archaeology professor got permission to go into the Führer Bunker, and they filmed all through the Führer Bunker, and we offer a CD with all that on it.
Hmm.
Then about 8 or 9 years ago, they found another one called the Fahrer Bunker, which means the driver's bunker, which is where they had some of their staff. It was just the way it was when the guys walked out and locked the doors. So they've resealed that, and they won't open it up for anybody. There's also underground air raid shelters, which we visit. And every place you go, in Nuremberg, for instance, when we were over there just recently, there's this little building right on the sidewalk that has no doors or windows, but if you look behind the picture of an Elvis impersonator, a poster.
I remember.
Yeah, you turn the key and you go down into a massive underground bunker, again, only for shark hunters. So they were very enterprising people.
In the East, there are extraordinary underground tunnel networks.
Yeah.
Which had trams and trolleys, and it was apparently where some of the atomic bomb research was going on. And
that's in the Thuringen province.
Yeah, and there's one tunnel in particular that goes down, and they blew it, and a lake came in and filled it up, much of it. You can still go down until you reach the water level, and you have to back off, but divers have been in there trying to get through, and I had an interesting story. If I find it, I'll send it to you years ago. But
okay, good, yeah.
There's a lot under there.
That's dangerous work. I'm a scuba diver, too, and that's damn dangerous work. You go into tunnels and caves, that's dangerous enough, but if you go into tunnels and stuff that have been blown, you don't know what's going to fall down on you.
No. Well, they blew it to keep people out from whatever was on the other side of the water, and no one has gone in there.
There were at least 24 bunker complexes in the Jonas Valley, Jonastal, which is part of Thuringen near Ohrdruf. That's where the German atomic research took place. They also had a factory inside a mountain where they were building ME-262 jet fighters.
Yeah.
It's also where we think the famous Amber Room disappeared, the Bernstein Zimmer. And if you remember the last issue of the magazine that you got, we showed photos of the Amber Room, and we showed photos of it being loaded onto trucks. And we had an official communique in there from the officer, the SS officer in charge, saying that they had hidden the Bernstein Room, Bernstein Zimmer, and they had blown up and camouflaged the entrance.
Hmm.
One of our members has some ground-penetrating radar and all sorts of great stuff. And we'd like to go over and start looking for this, but it takes a ton of money.
Yeah. Inside the mountain?
Yeah.
Anybody?
There are a few of the tunnels and bunkers that you can get to, but others have been blown up and camouflaged.
Mm-hmm.
They're everywhere. The town of Hallein in Austria, there's a huge underground complex, and we've got maps of it. And so I wrote to the village big shots there and asked if, you know, told them we were scientific people and researchers, and asked if we could have permission to go in. And they wrote back and said, no, it's too dangerous. Dangerous, my eye. They just don't want people looking in there.
That's right. There may still be 262s and various stages of development. We don't know what's in that mountain.
We don't know. Patton was ordered to pull out of a battle and head into Thuringen with all haste to get there before the Russians did, which he did. And after the U.S. was in there for a while, then they backed out and let the Russians have it.
Huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah. All right. Stand by. We'll be right back with Harry as we continue. Okay. Here we go. Back to the bunkers and our tour, our patrol with Harry Cooper, sharkhunters.com. This is, it, folks, if you're home and interested at all in World War II, the big war which really changed the planet as we know it forever, the last chance to really push the international Zionist banksters away, or at least into the background, and it was not to be. So now we are enslaved to a system that we have no interest in. They have the interest. It's called usury. All right. Okay, Harry. Let's go ahead.
Okay, now you're on the third batch of photos.
All right, photos number three under Harry's name and guests at rents.com. All right.
There you see, in the woods, I've drawn a red circle around another one of them signs that says, Shark Hunters Welcome.
There you go.
And actually that, and the next photo down, that was Admiral Dönitz's headquarters. And when we were there about 5 or 6 years ago, the place was in perfect shape. It was a home, and it was on the market. There was a real estate agent there with some people who were looking to buy the place, and it was in perfect shape.
Now, that whole entire big building?
Yeah.
That was his headquarters,
right,
before he had to retire to the bunker.
Yeah. It was still his headquarters anyhow during... They only ran to the bunker during air raids.
I see. So the bunker was right near there. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It was like about 100 meters away.
Okay.
So this place was, in my opinion, deliberately left to be vandalized. There were no signs of forced entry. And unlike so many other places,
yeah,
where young people come in and they have their drinking parties and whatever else with their girlfriends, You'd always find evidence of having little campfires on the floor. This
mm-hmm.
had none of that. This just had the doors and windows open and mm-hmm. just mass destruction.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually somebody will say, hey, it's beyond help. Come tear it down. The next photo is the daily train to Moscow left from this station. Right, this was the train station there, and every day the train had come and go between here and Moscow, because this was a major military base for the Soviets. Then you see another one of those gates with one of them signs, Betreten Verboten.
Got it.
Come on down. And now we see...
If you know Harry Cooper.
Yeah, Shark Hunters. Then we see the ruins of the 5th Panzer Regiment. The brick building, those were the tank repair garages. There's a lot more photos on the website, but this just gives you an overview. The next one was a headquarters building for the maintenance of the tanks. And the next one you see another tank repair building. And boy, oh boy, if you can't just close your eyes and see them Panzers and Tiger tanks in here, got to go see your doctor because you're not well.
I got it. Yeah.
Then there's one entitled General's House. The commanding general of the 5th Panzer Regiment stayed in that house, whoever he happened to be. Guderian
mm-hmm.
was lived in that house for a time. Guderian, the great...
Heinz Guderian, I think.
That's the guy, Heinz Guderian, one of the great tank generals.
Mm-hmm.
Then we move on. All this is in the same general area. The beautiful yellow building called the Kaiser Schule. The Kaiser built this for his cavalry.
Funny how they've maintained that one, isn't it?
Well, it's going to hell in a handbasket too, unfortunately.
Is it? No.
Yeah, you'll see in a moment. But his cavalry was there. His cavalry training school was there. A huge complex, many, many buildings. And then it was taken over by the 5th Panzer Regiment for World War II. Then it was taken over by the Soviets. And now it's taken over by nature. Roll up a little bit. You see the sign there, Betreten Verboten. And it says, take care of your children. Well, we didn't bring any children, so we just went on in. There's the grand staircase in one of the buildings. It occupies, I'm guessing, just a wild guess, probably 100, maybe 200 acres. It's a huge complex. Now we got another bit threatened for boat and sign, and we go into the swimming pool. Are you up with me?
I'm right there.
There you go. And it's been nothing for ever since the Soviets moved out. But you, again, you close your eyes and you got to hear the laughter and all the guys in there as they're taking their sports, and you got to wonder who swam in this pool and who climbed the stairs there.
Yeah,
you know, it's a piece of history that's, if I can borrow the term, it's gone with the wind.
Wow. Yeah, well, it reminds me of that complex with the enormous pool in Patagonia down there.
yeah, exactly. Yeah, I'll be there in about another month and a half. Now we have a small building with a gate with another one of those welcome signs, Privat Grundstück. In other words, this is private. Betreten verboten, the exclamation point.
Mm-hmm.
Which means shark hunters are welcome. The next next photo is a kind of a blown-up building. This was on the compound of the OKW headquarters, Oberkommando der Wehrmacht. In other words, high command of the whole military.
That's blown up, all right.
Yeah. Well, they had six of these hardened houses. They looked like a little village from the air, but these were hardened houses. And they had underground facilities, too, which you'll see pictures of that shortly. 90 meters underground, which is, what about
90?
Yeah, 90, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, Jesus, you better have strong legs because you're climbing stairs for a good part of it. But in one of these six buildings is where Operation Valkyrie was hatched. The assassination of Adolf Hitler was hatched in one of these very buildings.
Now, in short, Valkyrie was to get rid of Hitler so the generals could sue for peace.
That's correct. It was a stupid idea, and even if they'd have succeeded to kill Hitler, the Allies were not out to get Hitler. They were out to destroy Germany. So
just exactly. And you're right.
And then after the Soviets pulled out, of course, they were occupying this area, they blew all these places too, which is what they were supposed to do. Then we go through another gate, and you see us heading into the bunker entrance there. Two guys, the guy in the pale tan jacket with the hat, that's Erwin Burt. He was a U-boat sailor during the war. One of the fortunate ones to come home. He's really a nice guy. The next photo, a guy with a skull and crossbones on his back. We're in a meeting room 90 meters under the surface.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, way down. Then you'll see that tall, pointy thing.
Are any of the furnishings still the same?
No, because the Soviets took it over.
Uh-huh.
And they refurnished it their own way, and it was pretty Spartan. Bunks that just swung up onto the wall, and so when it was bedtime, you swung your bunk down. But we didn't find anything in there from the Reich.
Got it.
Many of the you'll see other pictures on the website that the Soviets pulled out, and there's still paperwork, and there's manuals, and there's desks, and there's telephones and computers all still sitting where they were sitting when the Soviets pulled out.
Hmm.
And they frown on you trying to take any of it with you. But we took pictures. Then you see that pointy thing.
That's odd.
Yeah, it's odd. There was a whole forest of these things, but then the Soviets blew all but one or two. These were air raid shelters. You run in, and there's a circular stairway going up, and they could put 400 or 500 people into these things, and the bombs couldn't hit it because it had no roof, and they were all hardened. But can you imagine being in there as the bombs are going off all around you? You know, the place move, and you hear the crump, crump.
What an interesting idea for an air raid shelter, though. They were smart. The shape of the building being round, the impact blast would just go right around it for the most part. It wouldn't knock it over.
And they had pretty thick walls, 4 or 5 foot thick walls. So you're pretty safe inside.
Huh.
But then, like I say, most of them are laying down on their side because the Soviets blew them, and there's only one or two that are still open. Next, we move to, you see, Stauffenberger Strasse.
Mm-hmm.
And you know who Stauffenberger was?
Yeah.
Klaus Schenk Graf von Stauffenberg. Then the next photo is police headquarters, which is on Stauffenberg Strasse.
We should tell our listeners just briefly who Stauffenberg was.
Okay. Stauffenberg was the colonel who had one arm missing and one eye gone, wore a patch over his eye. He's the guy that put the bomb under Hitler's feet.
On the wrong side of the leg, that huge, enormous leg of the table, which was a side-to-side kind of a vertical piece of wood, I guess.
Exactly. It was not a leg. It was basically a massive... A wall is like about 6 inches thick, solid oak.
Yeah.
But he put it right by Hitler's feet, and Hitler kept banging his feet on it, so he had it moved to the other side of this trundle or whatever the hell you call that thing. And so when the bomb went off, all that oak protected Hitler, and he was injured a bit, but killed a few other people. But Stauffenberg left. He wasn't much of an assassin. Most assassins will stick around to make sure their job is done. He left. He jumped on an airplane. We were at the very airfield that he took off from. And he flew to Berlin, and he landed, and he was proudly proclaimed, "Hitler's dead, and we're in charge now." And
whoops.
He was told, "Well, no, he isn't, and no, you aren't."
Yeah.
And so they hustled him out. That square door, that the vehicle entrance there, the police headquarters.
I see it. Yeah.
Right. Then you go into the courtyard. The next photo, you see that wreath hanging on a peg.
Mm-hmm.
The general in charge of the police was also a conspirator, but he wanted Stauffenberg out of the way real fast before Stauffenberg could blow the whistle on him. So they hauled Stauffenberg out there, stood him up against the wall there, and shot him within an hour or two of him getting into Berlin.
Right there.
Right there. And that's why they hang the wreath, and the sign above it says something about here died for Germany, et cetera, et cetera. So they make him out to be a hero because of today's modern Germany. But whether you love Hitler or hate Hitler, he was the leader of the country. And if you try to assassinate the leader of a country, whether he's good, bad, or otherwise, you're a traitor. That's by definition. So, but here they make a big whoop-de-doo about it. Then they've got a whole floor of the police headquarters that's a museum to von Stauffenberg and all the other conspirators.
Yeah, he's considered a hero now.
Yeah.
Politically correct hero.
Yeah, he was lucky, though. He got shot. Most of the others, hundreds of them, were tried in kangaroo courts and sentenced to a horrible death. They would twist a piece of piano wire around their neck, lift them up, and put the other end of the piano wire over a meat hook and just let the guy dance and dangle as the piano wire pulled tight across their throat. And they had movies taken of these executions, and Hitler had them sent to the people in the front to more or less let them know it ain't good practice to try to blow up the boss. I've been trying to find out where those films are to try to get a copy of them. They're in the National Archives somewhere, but, you know, that building where Indiana Jones lost his Ark of the Covenant when they brought it in there.
Yeah.
Then the next one down, you see the floor on police headquarters. They're anti-Nazi, but yet they got swastikas all around the floor.
Hmm.
And they seem to have their priorities mixed up.
That's then, contemporary. That's the way it is now.
Yeah.
When was that floor built?
It was built back during the time of the Reich.
Uh-huh.
And it's still there now today.
Yeah.
Unless they tore it up in the last 6 months, but I took this picture 6 months ago.
Yeah. Actually, a very nice-looking floor. Interesting.
Yeah, parkade, inlaid wood.
Yeah.
The next picture, a bunch of people all standing around. That's where the entrance to the Führer bunker used to be, but it's paved over. It's all down below there.
How big of a complex is that?
Yeah, it was kind of a living complex, maybe 100 yards long by maybe 60 yards wide. And I think it was a couple levels. But it primarily living quarters and...
But it's still there. It's still underneath.
It's still there, yeah. We understand now, though, it's starting to fill in with water because the pumps aren't running, and the water table in Berlin is fairly close to the surface because of the Wannsee right close by and the River Spey. Spray. So we hear it's filling up with water. And I don't think anybody in the government there is going to shed any tears over it. Then we see Checkpoint Charlie.
There he is, yeah.
My Shark Hunters group went through Checkpoint Charlie on the day of reunification.
That's amazing.
And with my translator, I went into the headquarters of the East Berlin Border Patrol and waved a couple of $20 bills under the nose of the DDR guy in charge and left with his left with the commander's heavy overcoat and his hat and an attaché case, which I still have.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but now Checkpoint Charlie is a tourist place. They've got guys there dressed in American Army uniforms.
Period piece.
Yeah, oh, well, yeah, and a couple of boxy-looking dollies dressed in American WAC uniforms, Women's Army Corps. And none of them speak English when we were there, but for a small payment, I think, 5-10 euros, they'll stamp your passport with an unofficial stamp, of course, that you were there leaving the American zone going into the Soviet zone. Not a lot of the guys went up there and got their passports all stamped. And it's a nice memory of days gone by. Then we stopped at the Olympic Stadium. Now, there's so much history here that most people don't know about. The 1936 Olympics, thanks to Hitler, were the first time the Olympics were a huge, big spectacle. Prior to that, they had been games, etc., but this was a huge spectacle. And Lena Riefenstahl, who was a member of Shark Hunters until her death, she filmed it, and we offer those DVDs of the Olympics. It's on our website. They had the parade. They had everything. Grandiose.
She also did Triumph of the Will, of course.
Right, and we also offer that one a clean, clear version, not all fuzzied up from recopying. And she was, like I say, she was a member, so she sent us
the
master. Tough lady.
Wow.
But what was interesting about the 36 Olympics, Hitler's date for the Olympics was, this was before he was going with Eva, was a Swedish beauty by the name of Inga Arvad, who was the mistress of a guy named Axel Wennergren. Wennergren was the wealthiest man in the world at the time. He owned 5 million acres of his native Sweden. He owned the Bofors company, you know, the pom-pom guns that everybody...
Yeah.
He owned that company. He founded the Electrolux vacuum cleaner company. He owned what is now Paradise Island in the Bahamas. That's where he lived. And his mistress was Hitler's date. She then came to the United States. The war was going on, but the U.S. was not in the war yet. She was 28, and she met 24-year-old John F. Kennedy. And they had a wild love affair. J. Edgar Hoover was trying to get Kennedy kicked out of the Navy.
Are you telling me that Kennedy slept with the same woman that slept with Hitler?
That's just the way it worked.
Wow.
Apparently, Inga Arvad slept with a lot of people, and so did John F. Kennedy. But, yeah, she was Hitler's date. She was also Winogrand's mistress, and she was the wild love interest of John F. Kennedy. So J. Edgar Hoover was trying to get him kicked out of the Navy. His dad, Joe Kennedy Sr., was still the ambassador to England and was buddies with Roosevelt. And he didn't want his kid getting kicked out of the Navy, but he also didn't want his kid messing around with a woman 4 years older than him, non-Catholic, and already divorced. So they hit upon the idea to send him to the South Pacific.
And that's how he ended up with
that's
his...
That's how he wound up there. He had been an intelligence officer before that. And after the war, they tried to rekindle, but it was... the flame had gone out. She wound up marrying... Now, you're too young to remember this guy, but it was Cowboy Tim McCoy.
I remember the name Tim McCoy.
Right, from the 1940s black and white
movies.
Cowboy movies. Tim McCoy had guns everywhere. He wore two guns on his belt, and then he had another gun stuffed down in each one of his boots. He had guns hidden behind his back. So you couldn't.
He married this woman.
He married her. And sometime in the 1960s, I think it was 1964, thereabout, she died of cancer on their ranch in Arizona or New Mexico. Can't remember which. Then the next picture is just Soviet officers.
She's gone?
She's gone long ago.
Mm-hmm.
All these people from the war, almost all of them are gone. There's only a handful left. The next building, and I know you're coming up on a time break.
We're out of time here. We're going to say goodbye here in just a few minutes.
Okay. Well, basically, the rest of it there is the Olympic buildings. And the only thing you have left is the memories, the pictures. The buildings are all abandoned, falling apart. And you see that one dormitory, that's where Jesse Owens lived.
Huh.
That's going to hell. And that's the last couple pictures. The Polish Museum when we went to the town of Kostrzyn. Then there's a basement. That's all that's left of Kostrzyn. That was the alchemist's house. And the king was unhappy that he wasn't able to turn base metal into gold, so they hanged him. But they used a golden rope.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
A little whimsy there.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm sure he was happy that he was hanged with a golden rope. I know I'd be overjoyed about that. This is also the place where Frederick the Great was brought in as a young prince because he and his buddy decided they didn't want to be in the army. They deserted the army because they wanted to play flute. They wanted to play the flute and write poetry. Okay, you read into that whatever you want.
All right.
They were caught, and they were brought back to this city of Kostrzyn, which is 40, 50 miles east of Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And the king decreed they were both going to have their heads chopped off, including his own son. And the nobility rose up and screamed and yelled, so okay. He pardoned his son, but his son's punishment was he had to watch while the buddy had his head chopped off.
Well, that certainly made an impression on him.
Yeah, and this is where we get the rabbit's foot is good luck. Frederick the Great, as a young man, had a really nasty father, apparently. He had a pet rabbit that he had to keep hidden because his father wouldn't allow it. His father found that he had him. He made Frederick kill his own rabbit, skin it, and cook it, and eat it. But Frederick saved one of the rabbit's feet to keep in his pocket to remember him by. So I think that's where we get the rabbit's foot. Yeah. And then after that, all we have is our farewell dinner in that little town of Kostrzyn, which is a touristy place, and they're still on the Polish zloty, so you're going to have one hell of a fine meal for nickels and dimes, practically. So I'm sorry I got Gabby there.
No, that was great. Are you kidding? That's just a terrific tour.
Yeah, and wonderful. If your listeners would like I say, just send me an email at sharkhunters@earthlink.net.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me they'd like to see a copy of the magazine. We'll send them a copy electronically. And they can go to the website, www.sharkhunters.com, and they can see hundreds more photos of all the places we've gone. We're going back to Germany again in 2014. We're going to go to Berlin. And then our other patrol is to the southern part, to Bavaria, where we tour places that... Germain to the founding of the Reich. We go to southern Austria where we participate in the memorial that the Waffen-SS has down there to everyone who fell in battle, no matter what uniform they wore.
Mm-hmm.
And we're putting together a couple extra days down into Croatia to Pola, which was a submarine base for the Kriegsmarine during World War II. It was also the Austrian Navy's main naval base in World War I.
Wow, fascinating.
So,
all right, that's great. That's going to be a good tour as well.
Oh, yeah.
Harry, thank you very much again. That was just great. I really enjoyed it.
Sorry, I talked so much there.
Are you kidding? No, these tours are very special. We'll talk to you next month. Have a wonderful time until we talk to you again. And again, everyone, it's sharkhunters.com, a doorway, a portal to all kinds of fascinating DVDs and books and history and photos of these patrols, which, again, number in the, I don't know how many, got up there, thousands?
Well, since 1987.
Yeah, lots. Thank you, my friend. Be well.
All right, same to you, and Merry Christmas if I don't talk to you in the meantime.
Okay, Harry, you too. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Harry Cooper. All right, we'll be right back.